This week's episode of This Is Only a Test is brought to you by Huawei's MateBook X Pro, winner of 27 global awards that now comes with Windows Hello. Unlock your Huawei MateBook X Pro with a touch of your fingerprint. Secure, fast, and no password to remember. And for a limited time, listeners of this podcast can get $300 or a gift card with purchase. Visit a Microsoft store near you today to learn more.
Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, June 21st, 2018, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a especially incredible episode of This Is Only a Test.
I got that joke.
Wah, 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 wah. How's everyone doing? How you doing, Jeremy?
I'm well. What was that sound? Wah, 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 wah.
He's doing the Corey Lewandowski.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not good.
No, no. That was no relation. It's just a sound I'm making. It's a joke. It's a joke sound. How you doing, Kishore?
I'm doing great.
Yeah? You doing all right? We are going to talk about that movie.
Yes!
In a little bit.
Oh.
But not now. Not now.
No.
We've listened to your concerns.
Apparently we know how Jeremy feels about this movie already.
Well, Jeremy's excited to talk about it.
Exactly.
And Incredibles 2 is what we're talking about. And I will say that we didn't talk about Incredibles in this week's Still Entitled. So you're not going to get overlapping conversation. But for those of you who listen to the podcast who may not have seen it, we're going to talk about it at the end of the podcast.
It hasn't even been out for a week. Give them some time.
I mean, how many people have seen it already? Like 20 million people have seen this movie already.
Record-breaking Pixar.
I think that's worth talking
first
about.
First weekend, $190
million. $183
million.
Dollars,
how dare you.
Highest opening for an animated feature ever.
Yeah.
And in terms of openings for films ever, it even beat films like Captain America,
Civil War. Yeah. In the top 10 openings of all films of all time.
Of all films. Yeah. Record-breaking Mondays, record-breaking Tuesdays. The point is, people are watching it. We've seen it. We're going to talk about it, but not right now. If you're watching the video, we have the lights in the back. If you want to jump forward to the Incredibles talk, the lights will turn a different color. I'm not going to even say what color.
Because we can't predict
what color
when we hit the button.
Yeah.
But it's going to be at the end of the show.
End of the show.
Yeah.
End of the show. Get that right out of the way. If you've been waiting for our impressions on Incredibles 2.
Well, people can't wait.
Hey, how were your weekends?
It was excellent. Norm actually saw me this weekend.
Well, oh. I drove by you this weekend.
He drove by me. I was a friend of mine. It was his birthday. And his wife is a model maker. And they decided to have a celebratory day of kickball. But instead of just doing normal kickball, they decided to build cityscapes. And then everyone had to dress up as various forms of kaiju. So we would run around tall buildings made out of cardboard.
Define kaiju.
Kaiju is any giant sort monsters. Of giant monster situation. Yeah.
Yeah. So I drove by this on Saturday morning in Golden Gate Park. I was making my way. The thing I talked about last week, did a small day trip with the Model 3 to see if I had any range anxiety. And stuck in a little bit of traffic, getting, you know, as is the case, getting across the Golden Gate Bridge. And as driving through Golden Gate Park, on right off to the side on the field, I saw people setting up what looked like foam blocks, cardboard blocks. I couldn't really tell what they were. And then among them was something that looked like the Coit Tower, which is one of the famous watchtowers in San Francisco.
It was like 7 feet tall.
Coit Tower. Exactly. I was like, that's the Coit Tower. And like, oh, the other things, those are buildings. Those are skyscrapers. What is this? Is it like a picnic, an art project? What could this be? And then we saw someone wearing what looked like a My Little Pony, like jumpsuit or some type of jumpsuit. And Danica's like, I think that's a kaiju meetup. I think these are, and I was like, is that like a different brand of furry?
No.
Because you
definitively
basically
no.
Adults dressed up as creatures kind of, wrestling and tossing around.
Yeah, I mean, well, less wrestling. I mean, here at Tested, we usually just call it cosplay and just be done with it. But in this case, it was awesome because everyone is like trying to kick the balls at the buildings. There's even a Nakatomi Plaza that I got inside later. And
emerged from?
No, I got inside and I ran around and all the monsters would chase me as Nakatomi Plaza. But there was like a Godzilla, Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
Nice.
I was a Yip Yip from Sesame Street.
Yeah.
I would bowl from my mouth.
Scale's not right exactly, but...
Hey, you don't know how big they were.
Sure, that's true. It's true. What were there formal rules for kickball?
We played standard kickball rules.
So where were the buildings relative to where the bases
were?
They
were like in between all of the bases. So you'd have to smash through buildings to get to where you're going.
Is that an automatic home run if you knock down Nakatomi Plaza?
No. No, it's just moments of pride. There was one building that was all Rampage. So there's just Rampage characters up and down the side of the building.
I
like in 8-bit style, too. It was pretty awesome.
Now, did anyone who participated bring like a GoPro wide-angle camera to put on a stick low to make it look like everyone was big, at the ground perspective?
No, we're focused on destruction. No humans showed up to slow-mo document from their perspective.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
It was pretty good.
All right, moving on.
Top story this week.
Our top story this week, well, it's a story of stars. Stars and science fiction franchises. We got some big Star Wars discussion, Star Wars news, and also some Star Trek news. No StarCraft news, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Not yet.
On the Star Wars front, this, I'm not sure if we can call this a rumor or such, if it's actually been reported and confirmed, but let's call it a rumor. Both Variety and Hollywood Reporter have reported that Lucasfilm is putting standalone spin-off films, Star Wars stories, the anthology films, on hold even after announcing a director for the Boba Fett movie, on hold given the performance of Solo.
Mm-hmm. We'd also heard rumors of a Obi-Wan movie in the works.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
They didn't... I think the comment wasn't that they were putting them on hold because of performance. It's just we know that to be true. That's the inference, that it must be because of that.
What is... Solo has not performed terribly well. I don't think it's earned $200 million domestic yet.
So I think there's...
Is that the case?
I think it's... If it has earned that, it's only slightly above that.
I think there's two problems. There's the domestic take, which is down, like, I don't know, 25% off of what Rogue One was, maybe a little bit more than that. That's fine. The problem is that Star Wars hasn't, especially these story films, have not done anything internationally, have not moved the needle at all. And specifically, they've had a lot of trouble getting any traction with these Star Wars stories in China.
Why is that?
I don't know.
It's really, and we kind of talked about it on the podcast a couple weeks ago of like whether Star Wars is an American phenomenon, whether the cultural significance is more so here, but we know it's an international thing. There are fans of Star Wars all over the world. I think you're right, though. China is a massive market, and every Hollywood studio has to consider the international take. In years past, you know, we look at American blockbusters and American films. The domestic release usually holds 50% of the take, right? 50% is America, 50% is rest of the world. Now it's increasingly so where the biggest budget films, the domestic gross is about a quarter or maybe a third of the total take, and the rest of it's international in the big markets like China, like South Korea, like Russia. And in Solo's case, it's made only 100. So I don't think you can call a movie that's made $200 million a failure. That's massive amounts of money. Right, even though it costs probably around that much to make. But overseas, it's only made $150 million. And that's where I can say only, because it's made much less overseas for a movie of this scope and the scale and this wide release. So it sucks that from a business perspective, Disney is putting some of this stuff on hold. Maybe it's not so bad from a creative perspective, though, because while the Boba Fett movie and the rumored Obi-Wan movie maybe on hold, they're still moving forward with the other trilogies. They announced two new Star Wars trilogies in addition to Episode 9 coming out next year.
I think the fundamental problem with this is that we're going backwards with these stories. And you're not telling a full vision. You're not selling people on a vision. You're basically like, well, you know the ending, but we're going to create like an interesting backstory for you. I think those backstories can only go so far. And yes, it was really interesting to see Rogue One because of stylistic differences. And Solo had that too. But style can only take you so far. Everyone wants to see the universe move forward. I think we see this fail in the Star Trek franchise when Enterprise failing so much comparatively to some of the other series, because I think going backwards is easy because the characters have been set, but I don't think that's what the fans actually want.
Do you think that that Solo and the Star Wars story spinoffs might work better as television shows?
No.
You don't think so?
I don't think so.
I don't want 20 hours and multiple seasons.
Because then it's drawing out that inevitability that Kishore is talking about. That lack of surprise, the lack of tension for what happens, who survives, what it's all building to.
I want new characters. I want new types of stories like that aren't just resulting on characters that have been around for 40, 50 years.
And to be fair, you're getting new characters in these Star Wars stories. You have the whole cast of Rogue One, new characters. You have, you know, new robots and new side characters and new rogues in Solo. It's just, what is that servicing? And are people watching? Do they stand alone by themselves? Are these movies on the strength of the Star Wars universe and the strength of what people know about Star Wars, or are they movies that can hold their own? And I think that's the bigger question. And hopefully this is a... These movies are being put on hold so that they can reevaluate the creative side and strive to tell interesting original stories that can stand on their own. Because I am excited for the new Rian Johnson trilogy that's been announced. I am excited for the David Benioff and D.B. Weiss stories, that the trilogies of movies that they're going to work on, because there's so much unknown. We don't know where in the universe they're going to take place.
I just think it's interesting they made this decision after one movie, one semi-flop. You know, flop in terms of Star Wars.
That's so disappointing.
Rogue One, by comparison, has earned $1 billion worldwide.
Yeah, yeah.
And granted, that's been out a lot longer. This Solo's only been out 3 weeks.
But they can track that.
They project where Solo's headed.
Yep.
And they think it's not going to do as well. And then fine. But it's one movie. Now, do they just think that this is the best they could have done? Are they so happy with the direction of this film that they think no one could have done better, so we might as well give up?
I think it's a question of opportunity cost. If they had infinite money and infinite release dates and infinite summers to put movies out, then they would continue. That one disappointment, I might even call it a flop, financial disappointment wouldn't deter them. But because they're in the business of needing to put it out, and for their shareholders, they're running it's running a business. You know, not only are they generating culture, they're generating money. They only have 2 or 3 times a year to put out these type of live action blockbusters, and there are only so many resources they can put into computing time for the artists and the rendering and the artists and all that production. Like, maybe focus your energies on the new stuff and not the standalones. I'm not too opposed to that.
Do you think Kathleen Kennedy's in any trouble?
No.
For what?
Well, I mean, this is not a good sign for her. And Last Jedi certainly got a lot of negative feedback and pushback that I think people are projecting are going to hurt box office for episode 9.
I don't think so. I think
really
episode 9 $1 billion.
Yeah, but you're going to be weighing that against Infinity War at 2 billion. I mean, that's how, if I'm the head of Disney, I'm looking at, why is this franchise at 2?
That's the most frustrating thing ever.
But that you movie, know that's what's happening.
Right. Like that if episode 9 doesn't make $1.5 billion, that would be considered a disappointment. It's the same thing that happened with like Avengers 2, like Age of Ultron. It didn't make twice as much as the first one.
And it's considered
a failure. Considered a disappointment. And
but what about that fan pushback following Last Jedi? You don't think that's going to have an impact going forward?
It shouldn't. It absolutely shouldn't. And if those fans don't want to buy tickets, I think they'll still buy the tickets. And then they don't need to watch the film. You know what? They could make their own film. That's what they can do. that's what the fan those fans, quote unquote. I'm gonna use quotes there. If you didn't see me use them here, that's what those people can do. And you know what? That's what they may be doing. It's just on social media today. there is a group of people saying that they have producers that they're working with that is offering to cover the budget for a, get this, a remake. A remake, a reboot.
A full remake.
Of The Last Jedi.
What does that mean?
In order to save Star Wars. Do you like this?
I do.
Right? Yeah. Like this line they're using. They want Disney to approve them to spend however many millions of dollars. You know, I don't think they have $200 million to spend. If they do, good for them. They probably have better. If you have $200 million to spend and the thing you want to do is make make The Last Jedi, go for it. What they want is they want legitimacy. They want the sign-off on the fact that this is that they would rather make a crappy film and say this is the version they're happy with.
You
and
mean
have that be the replacement in canon.
You mean low production quality crappy or poor, bad acting?
I think it could be all of the above.
Across the board.
Yeah. If they have the money and they have the talent and they have, you know, they have a world class special effects company behind them and a production company, make your fan film.
Okay,
make
$200 million
fan film.
I get it. Your comments are dripping with derision, and no one wants to see this made because it'll be crappy. That's fine.
They want to see it made. I want to see them take the attempt.
There is a small set of people that are still very angry at TLJ.
I don't think they're ever going to do it.
Of course not.
They're never. All they want is that. They want the attention to say that for someone to concede that someone else could make it better.
Why
which
hasn't
I can't.
This subsided? People have hated films since films started being made. What is it about Last Jedi that is stoking the flames? We saw this with with the actress that plays Rose, dealing with negative comments for months afterwards about her character. Like, why hasn't this gone away?
Because for some people, these films aren't just films. These films are important parts of themselves that they own. That, like, if a film, a commercial piece of work / art, isn't something they're satisfied with, they feel like their life is worse because of it.
My wife, who I'd be surprised if she could name all the Star Wars films in order, aptly said,
challenge extended.
Aptly said, when a new, you know, movie comes out, that seeing us, it appears as though a new chapter of the Bible is being released.
For some people, it is hokey religions.
Look, I didn't love Last Jedi. I'm not what, and like Jeremy, you're in that same camp. But I don't feel like this. What the hell is this?
Well, no, but you're grown up. You have children in perspective.
Am I, though? I just spent the first 5 minutes of this podcast talking about building buildings so I could kick a ball at them.
We didn't even talk about your eBay purchase.
Oh. That was the most mature thing I've done.
I think it's
years.
Okay to love something, and it's okay to be passionate about something, but to revere something to the point where the important to feel like you are personally slighted and your being is affected.
The scary thing about this is the sense that fans own the characters, they own the story, because that's not the way it is, and it never can be that way. Even for me, that character is Thanos, the one that I had the most most feelings around, years of sort of devotion, some would say, but I didn't feel that way watching Infinity War. And I think this is a dangerous place for us to exist as a culture.
Really?
Wow, that sounded high on my soapbox.
It's not that important. I mean, I think where I've come to on this, as someone who didn't like The Last Jedi either, is that I think the movie that I wish had been made probably would have been a disappointment, a financial disappointment. I loved Blade Runner 2049 more than any movie I can remember in recent memory.
Yeah.
And it kind of flopped.
It did. Totally.
So
I think you're coming from a different angle. You wanted the artistic. You wanted even more artistic boldness.
I'm not even sure what I wanted, but it wasn't The Last Jedi.
Hey, and you know what?
I'm just sure that Disney probably would. They're measuring the beans. Like, they want to know how much money it's going to make. That's right. Their priority.
Right. And I think a lot of people didn't like the film for different reasons. I think the people who want to remake the film probably didn't want Blade Runner 2049. They probably wanted Force Awakens. again.
I didn't want Force Awakens to begin with.
The other thing I can't comprehend is movies are, especially these types of movies, are just way better now than they were in the previous, like, 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
Like, do people remember the prequels? Do they? Yeah. Like, that's what we live through. Just deal with it.
That's true.
Blade Runner 2049 ruined Last Jedi for you. It's okay.
Well, I don't know about that. But it was a superior movie.
Yeah, I completely agree. I love Blade Runner 2049. And for any of Last Jedi's faults or things that I disagreed with in terms of like how what the creative approach was, we have Blade Runner 2049. We had a great piece of film and art released last year.
That's right.
I'll go watch that again. That's anytime.
Right. In 4K.
In 4K HDR, Dolby Vision, Dolby Atmos.
Hans Zimmer just right there going like, dong. Yeah. Right next to your head.
Exactly.
Did
hey,
we have some Star Trek news?
Yeah, I was going to say, it's okay. There's always Star Trek. Hey, Star Wars fans, we don't want the toxic ones. Toxic Star Wars fans, you can go stay on the message boards. But always welcome Star Trek fans. It's the time for Star Trek is now. Not only do we have Star Trek Discovery, which, again, may be divisive in the Star Trek fan community, just like Star Trek 2009, the reboot was, and Into Darkness and Star Trek Beyond. But Star Trek fans, whether you're old or new, you should be excited that there may be a lot more Star Trek in the works, TV shows and films. Now, on the film side, already we know there are potentially two films in the works. There's the official sequel to Star Trek Beyond, the fourth film in the Kelvin universe timeline that they announced a director for.
Hey, it's even numbered. What can go wrong?
Exactly. It's going to be a good one.
What is Kelvin from? What does that word come from?
It's a ship. Kelvin was the USS Kelvin was the Captain George Kirk, or
in the beginning of Star Trek.
So when the ship was destroyed, when the Narada, the Romulan mining vessel came into the pass and destroyed the Kelvin, the destruction of the Kelvin created a new timeline, and that's why it's called the Kelvin timeline.
Kirk's father's ship.
Yes.
Okay.
The modern J.J. Abrams. Justin Lin films.
Cool.
So that next film, totally excited for that one. And of course, on the other side, there's the Quentin Tarantino project, which may or may not be Kelvin timeline, but that's a film project that Paramount's developing. I actually have a theory. Would you like to hear my theory for the films?
I think we must hear your theory.
I think you're going to hear it no matter what. I think they already said that in Star Trek 4, they're going to bring back Chris Hemsworth. Because you realize Thor was Kirk's dad, the actor?
Did. Only after.
Right. He wasn't a big deal, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But now he's a big actor now. And Paramount's like, well, let's get him back. And they're going to have the Kirk meeting Kirk's dad storyline that I don't know if we needed, but.
Is that because he's become a big deal? Is that why they're doing that?
I think that's part of it. Yeah. And I think it provides closure in the Kelvin universe. The Kelvin film started off with the creation of this timeline with the death of. The birth of Kirk and the death of Kirk's dad.
Powerful moment.
I think they're going to collapse the timeline and retcon it all and erase that timeline with this fourth film.
Well, you can't do that.
Yeah, you can.
They're going to retcon the shit
can.
Out of it. Yeah, that's
I think Kirk and crew will sacrifice themselves.
Star Trek has never played around with time travel in weird ways that have changed storylines.
I think they're going to all meet in the Nexus. I think that Kirk and crew will sacrifice themselves and save George Kirk in the end. And George Kirk will go back to the beginning of the Kelvin timeline and live out the reboot the universe again and realign it with what we know to be a Star Trek.
Okay. All right.
That's my theory.
That's a fine theory. I hope you're right.
Well, if you don't care for the films, there's going to be potentially five new TV shows.
I love that they're excited about Star Trek TV shows again because of the success of Discovery. I have never wanted multiple Star Trek shows at the same time.
What?
But you had it. You had it.
You had it.
There was only one season.
Two season overlaps and then with DS9 Voyager.
Really clear that TNG was coming to a close. Really clear that DS9 was coming to a close. When those other shows started, and it was like, oh, we're going to help launch this other series.
You think the creative energies are such that you need to have the production teams focused on one
show.
I would rather just have one great show.
Well, we might get five great shows. Alex Kurtzman, who is one of the co-writers on Star Trek 2009 and Into Darkness, along with Robert Orsi, they also both wrote the Transformers film. He is now the new showrunner of Star Trek Discovery after the previous showrunners left the show, and one of the writers, Akiva Goldsman, I believe, also left the show. Controversial in their own right in terms of the fan base and what they like of their work. But Alex Kurtzman has, it's noted, longtime fan, devoted fan of Star Trek, and he signed a deal with CBS to develop up to potentially five shows. One of the shows is Starfleet Academy, potentially.
Red Squad.
I'm excited for a Star Trek. That's Earth-based, we've talked about Starfleet Academy even since the days of TNG. There was Starfleet Academy, the video game, like that episode of...
The Wesley episode. So good.
It was actually a good episode. Yeah,
there's a lot of opportunity there. And I think there's even a talk of the showrunner, you know, people who've worked in the young coming of age type shows working on that. So I'm looking forward to that. The one idea that I'm super excited by is a return to TNG.
What are you talking about?
The rumor is that Patrick Stewart may come back.
Oh my God.
As Captain Picard in a TNG sequel. Just him.
What?
Just yes. him? No Riker to be like, why are you still commander? Why haven't you taken captain of a ship yet, Riker?
That is the rumor. That by far in nerd culture may be the biggest news this week.
Is that like and 25 years have passed?
Yes.
So it's like real time.
Yes.
Is he like an admiral, you think?
So start
professor.
Perhaps. You know, we would talk about how Star Wars, one of the problems creatively with the standalone stories, they're going backwards, right? Nothing's pushing Star Wars forward. Well, Star Trek's been stagnant. The future has been stagnant for over a decade.
For no reason either.
Right? Yeah, Star Trek Online, I know there are fans out there, and that's been kind of pushing some of that story forward. But in terms of TV and film, it's all been retrospective. The whole Kelvin timeline is retrospective and a reboot. You know, at the end of Voyager is really the last time on screen we saw the Federation.
And even that wasn't technically going forward because they were sort of stuck in time because they were away from.
And and I think you could consider Star Trek Online like this Star Wars EU. And I'd be happy for them to take some of those elements and maybe reboot some of those elements. But Star Trek series, and maybe this is a limited series. I don't know if it's going to be ongoing. So the four shows that they talked about is a teen-oriented Starfleet Academy. From Josh Schwartz I think he might have been, is that the OC guy? In Runaways. A limited series, so two limited series. One limited series based on Khan.
What does limited series mean?
I mean, and not set to go for multiple seasons. 10 episode.
Is that like a pilot season? If it's successful, they'll continue it?
No, I think this allows them to be like True Detective, where they can say, we're going to get a good name, like good actors, and not commit them to multi-seasons and just say, let's tell this really tight 10-episode thing, 8-episode thing, and be done with it.
Okay.
I'm done with Khan. I don't need a Khan series.
I'm not sure I needed a Khan series either. But this one potentially is being spearheaded by Wrath of Khan director Nicholas Meyer. So I'm excited for that. And then an animated series.
That I could be down for.
Yeah.
There is a renaissance of animated films and movies and shows right now that I feel like is sort of under the radar for a lot of people.
The first one
that I think they could really tap into.
The original animated series gets kind of forgotten and swept under the rug because it's not great, but they did things that they couldn't have done in the show.
Absolutely.
And it wasn't a throwaway. It wasn't a money-making spinoff. They did it because they couldn't make the full live action, and that's all the same writers. Like, the writers of the original series consider the animated series the last seasons of the original series. So the Picard's one is the big don't hold your breath, maybe.
I'm holding my breath, dude. That's the best news of the day.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's been 25 years since the end of TNG.
92.
Yeah.
26 years.
Yeah, because
he's got to be an admiral.
2 days ago was the 28th anniversary of Best of Both Worlds airing for the first time.
Oh, the greatest TV cliffhanger of all time.
That's right. So these would be for TV or for the streaming service?
I think
for
streaming service.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I think all of this is CBS potentially spending a lot of money on CBS All Access.
What?
Good for them.
Did they bring Discovery to to TV yet?
The broadcast? No.
Yeah.
Wow. No. There's more money in the streaming service.
They have some problems to deal with Discovery. I mean, not only from a storytelling perspective, but they fired their showrunners this past week because of verbal abuse allegations on set. So we'll see if that's going to change what Discovery looks like going into this year, and if that in turn has effects for these new potential shows.
So I want to hear from you out there. Let's just talk about Star Trek. What are your hopes, your fears for 5 new potential Star Trek TV shows and the 2 Star Trek movies that are in various states of
pre-production? And what role should Picard have 25 years later?
Oh, God.
I just still can't believe the Ferengi aren't Captain getting their own show yet.
Let's brainstorm. Not Captain of the Enterprise. A new Captain of the Enterprise. He can't be Captain. You don't win Captain for 25. He's got to be Admiral status already.
At least, yeah.
Maybe he's going by archaeology. Maybe he's even retired from the Admiral. He's not deep in the Federation. He has all the knowledge of being a captain and running the Federation.
Doesn't he have a vineyard?
That's back on Earth. That's his family. They all died. Did you see Generations? He cried. He broke down.
I forgot about that.
It was the saddest moment.
It's been a long time since I've seen Generations.
He has a lot of love interests spread across the galaxy. We know that. But maybe it's the one of my favorite Star Trek Next Generation episodes is the archaeology episode where the Romulans, the Klingons, and the Federation are all hunting for this artifact, and Picard's old archaeology professor sends him on this path, and they find the secrets of life in the galaxy, and that they maybe have more in common than they think, and I would like him to pursue that path, right, Picard, the space archaeologist, with intergalactic diplomacy.
And
spread
the Borg.
Out. No Borg. Remember a couple weeks ago when we were talking about Fox having another potential suitor, 20th Century Fox Studios, was going to sell to Disney, and then Universal came in, and Comcast Universal with a whole lot of cash.
Bam.
And said, we want to buy you. We want the mutants. We want Deadpool. We want Aliens. And Disney said, no. Here's some more cash. The deal's been... It's a bidding war now.
Well, first of all, Disney was all stock.
Ah.
Right?
Previously. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So have they offered cash now?
They have now offered in cash and stock. I'm not sure what the exact split is, but $71 billion.
B-b-b-b-b-billion.
That is insane.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
$35 billion, half of it in cash. $35 billion in cash.
Holy cow. Man.
That's amazing that Fox just increased in value by about $18 billion in just a couple weeks.
You think Universal's like, they call their bluff? We found a way to get Disney to spend some more money, because that's a lot of bees in there.
It's an expensive bluff too.
Yeah.
Who do you want? Who do you actually want to win?
I'm Disney. I want to see some. I want to see the mutants in Avengers. I wish they could come to some agreement like Sony and Disney has in terms of sharing Spider-Man.
Are you worried about Disney having all the money and all the properties?
Of course. Yeah.
I mean,
I'm worried about that, but the thing I want is new characters and new franchises and new things.
Yeah.
Right. But if they're going to spend the money and hundreds of millions of dollars making superhero films until no one sees them, let's have the X-Men in a Marvel film.
I was at the Disney store yesterday cuz I just happened to be downtown, and I was walking through it, and it struck me, even at the Disney store, it's Marvel. It's Star Wars. You know, it's not just princesses and Mickey anymore.
That's right. Yeah, Mickey is not the thing at Disney.
No.
It's Iron Man. It's Captain America. It's the Hulk.
And currently, it's Incredibles 2, to be honest with you.
No, that's true. That's true. We're not talking about that quite yet.
Not yet.
Hey, how about another reboot? Did any of you watch the Michael Bay Ninja Turtles film?
You could have just stopped at Michael Bay.
Well, Ninja Turtles, beloved franchise. That's a toy brand and a toy line that I think the Toys That Made Us documentary could do.
Is there enough?
There are so many Ninja Turtles toys.
Old school enough.
That's the one that I grew up with.
I know.
I mean, I like the vehicles in that, especially.
Early 90s. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, Ninja Turtles may get reboot again. I think Paramount has the rights to that. Yeah. Yeah. And they've done TV shows, but they got writers. They've hired writers. Michael Bay will produce, so he's not completely detached yet because he's still in the Paramount family. But it may be another take on it, which that's fine. I don't hold it super, super dearly, and I like Ninja Turtles. I think it could use different personalities and different approach stylistically.
Keep that sweet song, though, man. That's a good song.
Was that song in the last one? No, they sung it in an elevator. That was very, very surreal. Yeah. Good jingles. Good jingle. None of us here have MoviePass, right?
Nope.
Well, MoviePass, the idea of MoviePass maybe wasn't so bad. I think most of us here were skeptical that the company could run it at a loss and stick around. Mm-hmm. And what was their real business strategy? Well, AMC's come in, and the biggest story in Hollywood this week is AMC, which has previously shunned MoviePass and not accepted MoviePass at their theaters, is starting their own MoviePass-like subscription.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and other theaters have followed suit, like Cinemark, which is, you know, based out in a few markets.
Cinemark has the XD and the Century Theaters.
They have a model that's, I think, $9 a month.
But that's one ticket.
But you can only watch one movie. So this AMC model is also, I don't think it's the complete exact, you can go to as many movies as you want.
It's
it
a
has
lot.
Restrictions.
It's $20, which is a lot to ask for a subscription. But realistically, that's actually less than people who watch movies regularly spend. $20 a month. It's called AMC Stubbs A-List. And here's how it'll really differ from MoviePass. It's going to include IMAX and 3D.
IMAX tickets cost $20.
Yeah, $22 in San Francisco. And you get free upgrades to popcorn and soda.
What's that mean? Like a size up?
Free size up. Mm. Yep. And it's 12 movies a month. And you can watch movies again. You can repeat.
And it includes 3D, I think.
And it does include 3D. Yeah, it's starting next week. I'm tempted. We have a lot of AMC theaters.
So
in the Bay
I think
area.
Their bet is basically you'll only watch one movie a month with this.
Well, that was MoviePass's bet too.
Right.
That you'll watch one or fewer movies a month. Here, if you watch two movies a month, and in the summer, not that difficult. In the fall, in the spring, maybe a little more difficult.
Can you use this for more than one ticket at a time?
No. That's where the Century Theaters one, the Cinemark, lets you buy for a friend at $10 each. Here, they want individual people to spend $20 a month.
This is basically just, you know, marketing movies to singletons out there, people that like seeing movies by themselves.
Yeah, or, you know, I guess it's
just joking.
Or if they go with friends, if they're going Dutch,
yeah,
then it makes sense. The Cinemark tickets, they do roll over, although right. I don't know how many.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, either way, this is their way of competing with Netflix, with streaming services, getting a monthly fee, getting you to buy the popcorn, getting you in the door.
For me, none of these services really work because I'm now like just completely sold on reserve seating because it takes so much out. I didn't
reserve seating works.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with this new one.
Oh. Now I'm back
advanced reservations, you can hold maximum of 3 movies at any one time because you can book it well in advance. It's not like MoviePass where you have to do it like 20 minutes before. And you can do it all online. That's what makes it really interesting. You can see up to 3 movies a week. Kids, like if you're in college, that's pretty good.
Wait, 3 movies a week?
Yeah.
And how many per month?
No carryover, 12 total. So
okay.
So 4 weeks in a month, 3 movies a week.
It's a ton of movies.
And no week if you watch fewer than 3.
You know, people who, movie reviewers, I mean, they get invited to events. But people who do this professionally, this is probably an instant buy.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Well, I like watching movies. I'll try it for maybe a month or two. Now is the perfect time in the summer to do it. And unlike MoviePass, you know, where you buy a year in advance, maybe if I'm not into it, I can cancel. I don't know if they'll force you to stick to it.
Yeah, your time is about to become heavily divided.
Yeah.
I think a while back we talked about one of my favorite comic book series, Robert Kirkman's Invincible from Image Comics. This is a story of a teenager, a college student now, and now young adult who grew up being the son of basically essentially a Superman type character, and developed powers of his own, and then entered the world of the Image Comics superheroes. Really great serialized comic, like Walking Dead, like Robert Kirkman's other series. It's been going on forever, although he's now announced an end for it. And I think they had previously talked about doing a movie for this, and the movie was going to be, I think, Seth Rogen and Evan Goldman.
They were producing
Evan Goldberg were writing it. And now the rights are going to Amazon to do it into an animated series.
I'm more excited about being animated. I think it makes sense for the universe.
And it's going to be, and the thing I'm more excited about is that it's going to be serialized as opposed to a 2-hour movie, 8-hour long episodes.
Which also makes a lot of sense for this story.
You read this series?
I think it needs to be animated because so much of the like kind of superhero adventuring and destruction and combat is so at a world scale for this show. Like one of the great things about Ryan Ottley's art in this is these double page spreads of like huge numbers of heroes on pages at once, or massive destructions. Actually, it's very akin to the Dragon Ball series. It's kind of an American take on the Dragon Ball series. If you like that, totally check it out. I can't wait for the Amazon animated series.
Image Comics was developed by Sam Keith to put the artists more in charge, to give them more say in the storytelling and the look of the books. That's what, because I came to it from the Max. That's the only reason I know about that at all.
Oh, I haven't thought about the Max in so long.
Max was great. It was one of the best MTV series ever.
And then last week we talked about John Lasseter leaving Pixar to end this year and stepping down from running Pixar and Disney Animation Studios. And now Disney, and we asked ourselves, well, is someone going to take his place? Does Pixar, Disney Animation, need these kind of creative figureheads to lead the direction of the studios? Or is the brain trust enough to guide the storytelling? And Disney has now answered that by putting two people in charge. It's going to be a pair of people. It's going to be Pete Docter, who, of course, directed Inside Out and Up and
Monsters, Inc.
Monsters Inc., as well as Jennifer Lee, who
really
directed Frozen.
No kidding.
The highest grossing animated film of all time.
Wow.
Makes these, I think, are perfect co-leads for the directions of these animation studios.
That's huge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because a lot of, it was rumored to be Andrew Stanton split with Pete Docter. This is very interesting.
Yeah. I dig it.
Gosh, has Pixar had a female director besides Brave?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either, although the new Bao was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true. And then finally in pop culture news, a couple trailers I want to talk about. Robert Zemeckis has a new trailer out for his next film. It's called Welcome to Marwen, and it's a drama comedy that's actually based off of a 2010 documentary, highly recommended, called Marwen Call. Documentary is about a man who suffered a traumatic injury, and in his personal rehabilitation, he built a fictional world, World War II, at sixth scale with essentially G.I. Joe figurines and dolls, and photographed them and documented the life, created this world as a form of therapy. And Steve Carell plays him in this film, as well as Leslie Mann, Janelle Monáe. And the trailer looks really fun, and I hope they nail. I think it's a
they create a transition between the real world and
they
that
blend them exactly
in a way that was pretty stunning in the trailer.
And so, you know, Robert Zemeckis loves performance capture, and so the actors have their parallels in these dolls, and so Steve Carell is also a version of himself in that world. So it's kind of perfect for that. Also, Robert Zemeckis is. That's his like thing these days. He's taken these critically acclaimed documentaries and then created the fictional recreation of them. He did it for Man on Wire, about the French guy who walked between two towers, which is a great documentary, pretty good film.
And he's doing it again here with Welcome to Marwen.
The trailer looks very surreal. It feels like being John Malkovich.
Yes, yes, a little bit of that. I think it's a screenwriter's challenge for this one because there's so many affecting moments in the documentary and little twists and turns. It's going to be really difficult for them to create comedy elements, you know, humor in this, some lighthearted elements when the basis of the story is pretty dramatic.
Steve Carell's done a great job transitioning to drama, but I miss his comedy. He's funny. He's one of my favorite funny guys.
Did you see Battle of the Sexes?
No.
He was actually reasonably funny in that.
Yeah.
Underrated movie.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. Creed 2 trailer is out.
What a trailer. So good. It was. You guys
both
are laughing.
Those stars, Michael B. Jordan and Tessa Thompson are much bigger stars now than when the first Creed came out. And so you have Valkyrie and Killmonger together again. Not together for the first time.
First of all, let's give it up for Ryan Coogler. He went from Fruitvale Station, which is this brilliant indie movie, to Creed, which was, you know, chronically underrated and started to get its due. If you haven't seen Creed, Creed is amazing. It is. I think Creed is the best Rocky movie.
Damn.
Like, period.
Better than Rocky?
I think it's better than Rocky.
Dude. Okay.
So he's not directing this one.
I know, but he's still involved as like a producer. So that's why I want to give him his due. Like going from there to Black Panther, and now he's involved again with Creed 2. I just think it's going to be pretty amazing.
I don't want to spoil the trailer because
there is a spoiler in the trailer.
So
what? I watched the trailer and I don't even know what you're talking about.
Well, the nemesis, the antagonist.
What is there a reference?
I might want to go there.
All right, fine. Because I didn't see
Creed. Jeremy did not apparently forgot reference? To watch. The end of the trailer?
Have you watched the Rocky series?
Yeah.
Is that
a reference to that?
Yes.
It's been too long.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
The moment it happened, we were watching it, and it was like screaming out at the TV.
They're doing it. I could hear the entrance music.
Yeah. Woo. Got chills just thinking
about it. Pretty awesome.
One final bit in pop culture news. If you're a fan of Penny Arcade and a friend of our friend Gary Whitta, you may know that they collaborated years ago on a comic strip miniseries that was hosted on Penny Arcade called Automata. It was a 20s era noir detective story with a world where humans work alongside robots and very stylized robot creations and great funny writing. And fans of Penny Arcade really latched on to this Automata universe, even though there were only like three strips about these two characters. To a point where they did a crowdfunding campaign and raised a couple million. It was a lot of money to produce a couple short film series based in this world. And the first episode is on YouTube now. And I think it's worth watching.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Automata, and it's on the Dust YouTube channel. Doug Jones is in it, playing the robot. We have a long list of things to talk about in tech, so let's start right with Sabotage.
I know you're making a joke, but this is really crazy news out of Tesla that started only a couple days ago, where Elon Musk out of nowhere comes out and says that internally at Tesla, a trusted employee has been actively sabotaging the company and stealing company secrets. And he kind of inferred that information was being fed either to journalists or rival companies.
This was an internal memo that Musk sent out to Tesla, but of course
all of their employees
was leaked immediately.
And in the subsequent days, Tesla has filed a lawsuit against this ex-employee. So the person is revealed to be someone named Martin Tripp, and he has come forward and done interviews with CNN and Ars Technica to tell his side of the story. And he admits he took information, but he calls himself a whistleblower. And the story quickly went from sabotage, talks of sabotage, to talks of whistleblowing and what information he felt like he needed to share.
Well, let's actually talk about for a second before we get to that distinction, because I think it's really critical here, what he was actually taking, like the information, because Elon said he was taking information, including pictures of the manufacturing process.
Right, right. You would think that this is corporate espionage in terms of sharing secret technology for other car manufacturers, because plenty of car manufacturers want to get into the EV business, and Tesla is selling a lot of cars.
And how he did it was he wrote specific code that he loaded onto other employees' computer to take this information and send it off network.
Yeah. What Tripp says is that he was not stealing information and leaking information about the manufacturing pipeline, but about things he specifically noticed, including, well, let's start with the most timid stuff. One, things that Tesla underreported number of Model 3s made for shareholder purposes, that instead of making 2,200, they made 1,900 to inflate their numbers. Fine, whatever. That they were creating more scrap, that unnecessary scrap, and storing it potentially unsafely in their production facilities, the scrap metal and their battery facilities. Yeah, bad. That they were potentially shipping Model 3s with punctured batteries. What? This is the big one. The big one where he says that when he was working in Nevada, in the facility, he noticed, he observed that punctured batteries were put into Model 3s and shipped to users. If that's true, that's a big deal. That is a safety hazard, and that's worthy of whistleblowing.
Shouldn't we be able to figure this out? Like, there are Model 3s out there.
No, we can't figure it unless a bad thing happens, right?
They're like, so concealed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They would have to forcibly, like, what I guess he wants to do is force recall and get these batteries examined and get Tesla to admit that they actually did this, which they don't want to because they say they didn't. Like, this puts everyone in a bind. The owners, Tesla, I mean, I think this is a, if there's any realm of possibility,
does he have
true.
Any hard proof of this?
That's what he leaked. He said he leaked it to, and he had extensive conversations with one newspaper.
Yeah.
And that newspaper has yet to run its story.
What is
meaning
the evidence?
They haven't vetted the
exactly.
information.
So I bet this, whoever, whichever publication, and we don't know which one it is, whether it's New York Times, Washington Post, or whatever, is doing its reporting.
Yeah.
And when that story comes out, it could be a big deal, or there might be no story.
Right.
But I think it's worth considering that, you know, this is something that may be happening. It may have already happened.
And this story went from being bizarre to just absolutely wild in 24 hours, because the vehemence of the denial from Elon, like, struck me as just a little bit odd, because it was, you just don't see those kind of messages from CEOs in that way. Like, he was accusing him of espionage, basically. And then this response in the media from the person who tends to stay anonymous in these cases where there's, you know, court proceedings happening. Do you think we're going to get to the bottom of this with a potential news story? Or I kind of think this is going to be one we won't know the truth for a while because of the court stuff.
I mean, this is something that I want whichever newspaper, whichever publication has the information and is doing the reporting to do their due diligence and, you know, not look for a story that isn't there. But if there is a story, then carefully investigate it.
How do you do this given Elon's tax against journalism, too?
Yeah,
they have to walk a very fine line because of that.
And this puts those allegations against journalism to new light. It could be him getting ahead of it, just like the internal memo talking about sabotage and hacking. Try to get ahead of the story of this being, you know, reframe whistleblowing as sabotage. It's two sides of one coin, but whatever the truth is, I want to know.
You guys are taking a very cynical, pessimistic vantage on this. I mean, there is a principle of innocent until proven guilty here.
Oh,
there is no evidence I've seen to indicate that this is true.
I'm not even suggesting that there's anything at fault here, but it is a really wild situation going on here, like how quickly the story has moved.
Yeah. And if there is nothing at fault, I want them to be vindicated, and I want whichever
100%.
Publication that has the lead to do the investigation and report as such.
As a Tesla owner, how do you feel about all of this?
All I know is I was driving to work today, and I imagine if the car caught on fire, what would my next steps be?
Go on a podcast and talk about it?
No, I would grab my phone, grab my bag, get out of the car, start recording video on my phone, and take photos of the SLR throughout, and then put those on Getty Images and make money off of that.
Oh, my God.
Make money off of it.
So I got to pay for a new car.
I would
document.
Yeah,
as much as I could.
Is there special insurance for electric cars that I don't know about?
It's expensive insurance, but yeah, there's insurance. Like, I don't think it's special insurance.
If the batteries were to catch on fire.
I mean, they have a warranty, right? Yeah, so right. I would hope that if a battery caught on fire in a Tesla, Tesla would give you, like, we'll replace that car for you.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I would hope. But right. I don't know. I mean, the really shitty thing is for people who have had problems with their car batteries and caught on fire and posted them online, they've been attacked by not even Tesla owners, but people who are just fans of Tesla saying that they shouldn't be sharing that information because it's hurting the image of...
It's delicate.
No, you should be sharing it. People should know. Like, you can believe in an EV future and still acknowledge that it's it's imperfect technologies right now.
Right. Agreed.
Oh boy. Whew. All right. Moving on. Hey, let's talk about something more lighthearted. Instagram. Facebook's Instagram. You know, Facebook spent a lot of money trying to make Facebook Video a thing and the Facebook Video Hub a competitor to YouTube. They had spent a ton of not only infrastructure money developing the video platform because people share videos on Facebook and have now some people use Facebook not only as their main ways to the primary means of interacting with the world and reading news and quote-unquote news, but also consuming media content, but still pales in comparison to the number of people who are watching YouTube. And so Facebook tried spending money making shows, putting money in content creators' hands to make shows exclusively for their site. Didn't really work out, but they realized that a huge part of their audience is on Instagram. It's one of the reasons they bought Instagram in the first place. And being relatively hands-off with it, Instagram has grown to like 100 million active users per month, which is a massive number of people.
And just ate up Snapchat's domain with the stories.
And video is posted on Instagram, and Instagram knows how its users are using its service, yes, to share photos, yes, to scroll in a feed, but also to use that Discover tab, which I think is probably the most powerful of Instagram's abilities right now. Instagram's Discover tab is like Twitter's new Discover tab for news, except for entertainment. And so they launched something this week called IGTV. Now, I have problems with the name Instagram Television. Like, don't tie yourself to TV. Right, just call it Instagram Video or something. But it's not only it's a separate app, but also a new feature in Instagram where they're encouraging people who make content, whether they're photographers or videographers, to create video and share like YouTube-style content, hour-long content on Instagram. Right now with no ads, but they know it's a platform ripe for advertising, and that may be something that's happened. But right now they want users to start watching long-form video. Some of it vertical video, some of them square video, on the Instagram app and now IGTV apps. Either of you, are you part of that million or 100 million monthly active users?
I'm an Instagram user. I don't post stories that often, which is the most common way video is
don't ever do
shared. But I do follow a lot of people that do, and I've started doing it more and more. I think what you're poking at, though, is the discoverability and the shareability of the video hasn't been tested on the platform yet, which is, I think, the critical part of YouTube's success is, like, there's an algorithm that makes discovery really easy. Instagram doesn't quite have that be opaque in a way that I think is really necessary for success.
Well, I think both Instagram and Twitter are mobile-centric applications. Instagram more so because you really can only post and interact with it on mobile, where they've cultivated a user base and a interaction model where people are refreshing constantly.
Mm-hmm.
You're all people who are addicted
they get that satisfaction from pulling down to refresh and seeing new content. And on Twitter, if you're not following a ton of people, you're not always going to get new content. And that's why they started putting suggestions for tweets for people you may not follow on Twitter. And that's why the Twitter News and Discover tab is so successful, I think, is because it's a way for you to tap into new conversations on Twitter. And I think Instagram followed suit, and the Instagram Discover tab is hugely popular. And it's like Facebook, algorithmically knows the things you're interested in, because based on what you post and what you like.
It also knows your network.
And knows your network. And so that, while you're on Instagram and you maybe just scroll on the main feed to see new updates, that second tab of Discover is like, that's modern cable surfing, like channel surfing for small bites of visual content.
The way you're talking about it is in a way that you feel like YouTube should be worried about this.
Yeah. Well, YouTube's big discoverability model is their homepage, right? Mm-hmm. They algorithmically program their homepage, youtube.com, or when you
and
first
the end
load
of
the
videos
app.
Too.
And right. So when you, well, to get people in, to scroll and watch something, whether it's a 3-minute piece or a 10-minute piece, and at the end of it, autoplay or recommend, and then get people to start. But people aren't necessarily on YouTube as a social network the same way that you are on Twitter or Instagram or even Facebook are. And so YouTube, you go there specifically to watch videos.
And I treat YouTube more as a lean back experience, where especially if I'm having lunch or something, I'll go to YouTube because it's hands off.
Sure. Instagram has the kind of, you know, it gives you that satisfaction of new content in a feed, but also has these social benefits, the perks of a social network, and they can start shoving videos in your face.
They have to prove that they aren't just shoving all the videos in my face. They have to prove that they can shove good content.
Good content is important. And I think tonally there's a big difference between the type of videos produced on Instagram and Snapchat than there is on YouTube or even Facebook. Like, it's almost like the difference between YouTube and Vimeo. Like the types of videos people, and I think this is probably the thing YouTube is most confident about, is that right now, while Instagram may have 100 million active users, those users may not care for produced videos like the ones you'd find on YouTube. And they might even care for the subtitle videos like you see on Facebook. People go to certain platforms for certain types of experiences. And as big as a user base as you can build, it's tough to change expectations and behavior. Mm-hmm. Well, going right into that, Facebook, the other side of Instagram, is announcing that they want to get into the HU game. This feels like a little late for that.
They need a Scott Rogowski.
This is the big test. So they've developed technology in their for Facebook, for any Facebook user, to not only generate polls but to make quiz shows and put money to those quiz shows.
What do you mean put money to those quiz shows?
Like they can get sponsorships, or they can
really?
That feels like gambling.
Well, no, because it's knowledge based. It's not randomized at all. This is the shotgun at the wall approach for competing with HQ, as opposed to making one competitor and trying to get how many hundreds of thousands or millions of people playing at the same time. Instead, create a million game shows that have 500 viewers.
Game shows are personality based,
and this is where I think we'll find that. I mean, you may find the best. You may find, you know, in 10,000 game shows, you may have 100 great hosts, but what's the value of a curated experience like you find with HQ and Scott and the questions?
I could see people on other networks using Facebook's quiz tool just for that. You know, like if you saw like Ninja come over from Twitch to do a Fortnite-based quiz show, I bet he'd have a lot of followers, and if he has enough of them, then the money probably be pretty good.
And I think the value that Facebook sees is not at the scale of audience, is at the scale of shows. And so if you do have, let's say, 1,000 great or good to great quiz shows running on Facebook at the same time, each with a couple hundred people playing, you and your friends can play, and it feels more like an intimate, it feels more like the bar quiz experience, a bigger bar, but not as big as
the bar quiz experience at his HQ, which is hundreds of thousands of people.
But he says it's personality based. I say it's money based. If you don't have $1,000 at least up for grabs, preferably 10,
right,
you're not going to see people playing this game.
But even when you do, what's the most that any person's won on HQ in a single game?
Oh, a lot.
In general, it's like in the dozens of dollars.
In general, if that.
Right?
Yeah, no, less
right?
than
that. So it's not really.
But like on occasion, they'd go all in on one prize.
When it first started, it was higher per payout because there's less people.
Mathematically, if you have $1,000 up for grabs and only a couple dozen people playing, you know, a couple hundred people playing,
oh,
it's still the same.
If it's 1,000 up for grabs, that's great. But I'm afraid it's going to be 10.
No. They wouldn't do this unless they could get sponsorships.
Okay.
You know, I could see a model where Facebook's working with content networks and where I'll make a tech quiz show.
Yeah.
And Microsoft wants to sponsor one of the questions. And then that's where the money will come from. Facebook will take their take.
It's interesting.
It'll be the creator, up to the creator to not only bring the personality and the entertainment, but also good questions. And then they have the network to propagate to say, everyone in my tech community network, everyone play this game. And it'll be great. And it's focus and targeted advertising.
I think if Facebook really wants the money, they should just make a battle royale app and just release it in iOS, because that's the way to make money.
That is the way to make money. Fortnite on iOS. Mm-hmm. How much money do you think it's made in the past? Don't click the link, Jeremy. How much do you think it's made in the 3 weeks it's been out?
In 3 weeks?
No, 3 months.
Oh, sorry, 3 months it's been out.
How much has it made in that?
Just iOS.
I'm going to say $10 million.
Your order of magnitude off.
Is it 100?
It's $100 million.
Holy cannoli.
It's a free game.
I mean, all of that is skins and loot boxes and that kind of stuff.
That is insane.
I mean, that just shows you how big of a user base is happening. Though, I actually wonder if...
That's more profit than Solo has made, by the way.
No doubt. I mean, but the games are big business. I do wonder if we're hitting a Fortnite sort of peak. And the reason I suggest this is you can see Ninja's Fortnite subscriber total. He shows it, and it's dropped 70,000 in the last...
Out of what, though?
It was 230,000 paid subscribers to his channel. And now it's down to like 160. And some of that is drop-off from people using their Amazon Prime free thing. But that tells me less people might be watching. It's still a really popular game. They're going to soak money at it. But we might be near like a peak point for it. And now we're just going to be on the slow decline for that game.
Interesting. It's just a fascinating phenomenon to observe from the outside, because it's not in that Royale world.
Totally. And so now the question becomes, what's sort of the next thing?
Obviously, it's Rec Royale.
That's right. From 16 players to how many more can we get
there? You know why it's not Rec Royale? Is because people have gotten good at Rec Royale, and now I can't kill anybody.
They're good now?
I know.
Since we played over this past weekend?
Yeah.
I got a Scout's Honor at one point, but it was hard, man. You got to camp.
You got to camp.
That's not a way to win.
It's not. It doesn't feel right. It
doesn't feel good.
We played this weekend. We all got Scout's Honors.
Yeah.
Yeah, each of us. Hey, I didn't talk about my trip this weekend. Drove up to Santa Rosa in the EV and came back with over half a battery full of energy.
Did you charge out in the wild?
No, didn't even charge out in the wild. Okay. Yeah.
Right. It's almost like your 300-mile battery was well-suited for the 50-mile round trip.
Yes, exactly.
No punctures.
Well, not that I know so far. And if I really wanted to, I could start making some extra money with ride sharing. A little bit extra money on top of that extra money, too, because Uber is now starting a program to incentivize their drivers to switch to EVs. We'll pay extra money to you. You get a better rate if you drive an EV than you do with a gas combustion engine.
So when I've opened up Uber and Lyft recently, I haven't noticed like an option to be like, send me an EV car. Like, how are they? Is this just to build the fleet right now, and eventually they'll have that option?
It's not much of an incentive, to be honest with you.
Extra $1.50 per ride,
if you're lucky, and it caps out at $10 per week, friend.
Oh, so. Well, that's enough to charge your car for the week, maybe.
No, it's not.
$10 a week? You're better off
playing
Facebook game shows.
Yeah.
You're going to go through that 300 miles in a single day, don't you think?
That's true. And that's the one thing I've noticed going driving around and you know parking in public places with chargers is a lot of people at those chargers are rideshare drivers.
Oh, it's horrible.
Charging their cars between rides.
I misspoke. It's $20 max payout per week.
Ooh.
Yeah. Now
that will charge you. That will get you.
I wouldn't be. I'm not surprised by that because obviously they're just maximizing their profits. But in addition, like as a consumer, hell yeah, I want to get a ride in an electric vehicle. I feel better about my ride.
It's probably a newer car.
It's novel. Yeah, it's a newer car. All of those things.
There's a Model 3 owner who talked about running Lyft or Uber and the experience of giving the rides to people. And people thought they won a lottery. They're the riders. Like, ooh, did I get like a special thing? Like, why do I got a Model 3 picking me up? And it's fun anecdotally to hear people who've never ridden in one ride in one and appreciate and some of the design quirks, like the big glass roof and you know the way you open doors. I'm not gonna.
So I, one of these. You know what this article taught me that I found most interesting is Sacramento has their own locally publicly owned utility. Mm-hmm. Of superchargers, not superchargers, but fast chargers.
Oh, the DC chargers.
Yeah, so that's very interesting. I mean, that's the equivalent for the rest of us,
right?
Of the fast charger network.
Right. Well, you can't use those on Teslas unless you have an adapter.
I want to know more about that. Yeah.
My equivalent is still called a gas station for my car.
It loads up
pretty quick.
It does, unless you have fuel cell. You can load up really quick with hydrogen, but only 30 places in California. But that's the big difference I've noticed so far. Not having to go to a gas station in the past 2 weeks has been really nice.
Nice, right?
Yeah, super nice. Adobe has some announcements. You guys use Lightroom on mobile?
No.
No.
I use Lightroom on mobile.
On mobile?
On mobile. It's really good. Lightroom on iOS and Android is really nice. Mm-hmm. I really prefer downtime thing do is just tweak photos in Lightroom.
It just strikes me like video and photo editing is not something you do on mobile. Like I have
traditionally,
that
you don't think of that.
Barrier.
Mobile is a couple. There's mobile phones. There's also tablets. On tablets, it's great. Adobe is really leaning into it. I think they found real good success with Lightroom on tablets and phones, and they have a new project called Project Rush that's going to be video editing on mobile. Combining aspects of Premiere, After Effects, and Audition for you to produce videos. And we've done iMovie on iPhone, and I haven't used it recently, but even 4 or 5 years ago, it was pretty good. If you have like an iPad Pro, this Project Rush could be your first pass video editing device, especially if it has compatibility with the file formats in your library on your desktop. So one of the ways I use Lightroom Mobile is do first pass light editing on the phone, and it's all synced up to the PC, and then do the final pass on the PC on a bigger screen, better quality, and just more pixels. If you could do that for video, that could be really, really interesting.
The problem with apps like that, to me, have always not been their capabilities, but the user interface and how quickly you can get work done.
Right.
Now, obviously, the pencil adds another dimension, and mm-hmm. maybe that'll be very helpful. I'm not sure if iMovie on the iPad Pro supports the pencil.
I don't know.
I haven't
used it recently.
Seen that.
Yeah.
But maybe that's a game changer. I don't know. But until you can work as fast as a mouse and keyboard, it's always going to be it's a pain to use.
Especially the keyboard. Video editing is one of those things where keyboard shortcuts, you live and die by keyboard shortcuts. Mm-hmm. And you need to be pixel precise in terms of your timeline.
Right.
So photo editing, you can get away with sliders. You can use sliders left and right and draw your mass and stuff like that. But you're right, for video, and also multi-windows, right? Video editing is a situation where having lots of windows for your various menus, for your various media management, being constrained to a 10-inch screen or even a 5-inch screen on your phone may feel very limiting.
With that said, I mean, they are extremely powerful apps. Yeah. I've always thought GarageBand would be a system seller to a certain audience if it was the only app on the iPad because it is so powerful. Mm. I bet Adobe's going to make good products.
Speaking of music for the iPad, one app that just came out, free app for podcasters, and there are some podcasters I know out there listening, check it out, is Anchor. Anchor has a new iPad app that's all in one recording for podcasters. You record directly to the iPad via lightning cable or using the microphone, and you can mix and publish.
And it has compression filters, I assume?
I assume has all those filters.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
Does it have a little soundboard in it?
That's what I want to know. I haven't used it yet, but if it has a soundboard, maybe it's something we could even use.
A little backup device.
Yeah, yeah. Touchscreen soundboards are so convenient. Let's talk about Amazon. A couple bits of Amazon news. Two bits of Amazon news.
Mm-hmm.
This made the most sense in the world. Alexa being put in hotels.
Okay.
Totally makes sense. It's a cheap investment, high return, alarm clock, easy to set. Now, gives you like recommendations. You can display like ads and promote your services if you're the hotel on it. Potentially, later down the line, it can even control media and lights in the room.
That's the number one thing. When you go to a hotel, like a nice hotel, they have their own proprietary interface. You know, everyone at the hotel is trying to modernize. And if you go to like in Las Vegas, hotels have tablets, but it's all their version. You have to learn their interface, how to open the windows and turn on the lights and to play the music. Everyone understands Alexa mm-hmm. and understands the voice things you can do. You provide a list of voice tools. And because it's all tied in Amazon's network, and maybe there's pros and cons to this, the idea is that when you book your hotel room, you give them your Amazon account name.
I think that gets really dicey.
And then you have your information that you can access.
I want it to be like some sort of guest account.
Guest, yeah.
No, it's going to be room service, right? It's going to be room service and wake-up calls or alarm.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but that's what I mean by like a guest account. One that's going to remember me for my stay.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So
you don't want it to tap into your Amazon Music playlist and make phone calls. If you could go into a hotel room and without having to take a phone or a tablet out of your bag, tell the Alexa there to do a video call.
The security implications of sharing something that has that much access to my information.
No, everyone has
terrifying.
A device for that already. That's their phone.
That's their phone. I know.
Or their PC. Sure. Or laptop. Yeah.
All right. That extra bit of convenience. We'll see. I mean, it's a problem for Amazon to solve, honestly, and Amazon to be secure about.
Hey, I bought one of the new ones, by the way. The new Echo.
The Spot?
Spots?
No, the new Echo.
Like, the new Echo.
Shorter one with a fabric on the outside.
I like the look of those.
I do too. And it sounds better than the old original Echo, and it's smaller. I'm happy with it.
You use that as a music player?
Well, my daughter listens to more music than anyone in the family. And so I upgraded her from a Dot to, the $80 Echo.
Mm. Another Amazon initiative, maybe be more positive about this one, Amazon Hubs. These are lockers, storage lockers, that Amazon wants to put in cities and apartment buildings that basically become delivery mailboxes as opposed to going to the 7-Eleven storage lockers.
They already exist in so many places. Like you mentioned, they're at 7-Elevens, and they apparently have a ton of users already. I don't use this service just because it doesn't make sense for where I live, but the report is that they have 500,000 users using mm-hmm. this service already.
I believe it, man. There needs to be a solution to package delivery.
Yeah, I mean, that's
bigger,
why...
I mean, it's just a bigger mailbox. It's basically apartment buildings as opposed to having that small, your small mailbox having something that looks like a giant locker.
Well, or it's like my coffee shop has one. So it's not just in residences.
Right. Well, it's shared. So you have your account. Maybe it's, RFID or QR code based. And
some
you walk
of them
up
are thumbprint, I think.
And then I don't want to touch anything in the public. you tap your watch to the panel and then tells you which locker your goods are at. And then you can open it. And maybe get this. Here's a big idea. Maybe it'll help Amazon reduce the clutter of packages and not have oversized packages for small objects.
Maybe they could even not have packaging for certain things that come in like a plastic thing.
You mean if they know it's going to one of these?
Exactly.
It's a good idea.
If they're not leaving at your front step, Well, it might not benefit them. The reason they do big boxes is because it's actually cheaper and faster for them to have the biggest box for stacking purposes and shipping than it is to have lots of small boxes.
I'm thinking about the transit. It takes less space.
Oh, I completely agree. I think so, too. Maybe it's one box of all the stuff, and it's just labels stuck on them, and then the delivery person goes to the locker and throws things in in the different locker cubbies. Yeah, I'd be down for that. It also decreases human interaction. This is like, it feels like that dystopian future where you're just going to lockers and opening things and there's zero human interaction. We've seen it in movies all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quickly becoming a reality.
All right.
Yeah. Meet cutes at your Amazon hub. That's the next Hollywood rom-com. Netflix rom-com. Not me say Hollywood. Netflix. Yeah.
We should speed round some stuff so we can get to incredible spoilers.
My all right. God.
Yeah, so you're painful. Dying
it's so
here.
Painful.
Okay, Apple stuff. We've done Amazon. We've done Adobe. Let's talk about Apple. Apple phone rumors. The big rumor this year is not only a larger new iPhone, but also maybe different types of screens, OLEDs and LCDs. This is interesting. A lot of reports say that they're going to stick with LCDs because they're cheaper. I'd be a little disappointed. I would hope that they would stick with LCDs because they can go faster refresh rate. So the thing I want to see is
120.
Let's say even 90 hertz phone screen. I know it's going to be more consume more power. Yeah, do variable refresh rate. But then if they do LCDs that do high refresh rates, then they're going to have a split market because they have OLEDs that have really good color and brightness and power consumption. And LCDs, it's basically they have to choose one or the other. And it's unfortunate. I think they're going to stick with OLED as being the high end and LCD as the low end.
Okay.
But maybe people don't care and they just care about form factor and they'll pay $800 for a giant iPhone. Lots of phones this year with the notch coming out. A lot of non-Apple phones with the notch. One phone that does not have the notch is called the Oppo. The Oppo Find X. And this camera doesn't have a notch because it hides the front-facing camera inside it. There's a mechanism that pops the top of the camera up. And it's not just like a flash pop, like a very small thing. I think there's one other phone that does that. But the whole top of the phone, the whole width of it raises up mechanically to reveal a camera.
Hmm.
Clever bit of engineering. I think terrible long-term design.
Feels like point of failure to me.
Lots of points of failure. Yeah, it's the same fear I have for the Rift with varifocal lenses.
Mm-hmm. Why are people copying that notch, man? Is that just like copy Apple at all costs?
Yes. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I think it is. A Kickstarter campaign I want to point some attention to. This one I thought was interesting, photography related. It's called Instant Magni 35. You have an old 35mm rangefinder camera, like a Leica or a Nikon. And this is a kind of a little bit of bulky attachment. I think a series of mirrors, actually, that you put in where the 35mm film would normally go. And instead, it bounces all that light onto a Polaroid instant photograph. So using the lensing of your 35mm rangefinder, but then nice quality lens and pops out and you have Instamax Polaroid.
That's kind of cool.
Wow.
Yeah. It's already met its goals. There was like 24 days ago. Again, you can search Instant Magni 35, and I think it's about like $100 for Leica cameras, if you have an old Leica camera. I found a couple interesting things, bit of tech bins, things online. This one I think was so cool. It's a Scrabble lamp. So I've seen like Scrabble lamp tiles where they're light up lamp tiles. You can string them like Scrabble keys have a look to them. This one is a Scrabble tray with a pretty big Scrabble, like a double size or triple size Scrabble tray.
Yeah.
And you can put these letters on them. The letters are translucent and you can put them in any order. And they light up because there's a strip along the inside of the tray that conducts electricity.
Does it light up red if that's not a word?
No, that would be cool. I like that. It doesn't include a ton of tiles. It includes like 12 tiles or something and stickers that you can stick on.
That's weird. So the bulbs are actually in the pieces.
The bulbs are in the pieces.
Why wouldn't you put a strip in the base?
Because you want that negative space.
Mm-hmm.
To make people buy more tiles.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. One last bit of weird gadgety tech, a plug, like a power plug, a wall wart,
yep,
where it can detect inside when it's close to a wall outlet And when it gets close to a wall outlet,
yep.
not directly plugged in, it lights up. It has a little flashlight.
Why? Just so you could see it?
So you can see where the wall outlet is.
Uh-huh.
How many times you go underneath your desk
yeah.
and you're trying to plug a plug-in, a yeah. three-prong or two-prong in.
So where does it get the power to light up?
So it has like a tiny, tiny battery in there that will last, they say, for a very long time. But it incorporates a current sensing technology yeah. inside the plug itself.
That's neat.
I think that's pretty cool.
None of this is as good as Incredibles 2.
No. That's why we're done with technology news for this week. Let's move on. Before we move on, actually, to our next segment, I want to remind you that this week's episode of This Is Only a Test is brought to you by the Huawei MateBook X Pro, winner of 27 awards at Mobile World Congress, including Best of Show Laptop, Best Innovation, Best Design, Editor's Choice, and Reader's Choice. With Windows Hello, you can unlock the Huawei MateBook X Pro with a touch of your fingerprint. It's secure, fast, and no password to remember. Huawei's MateBook X Pro is now available at Microsoft stores, Amazon, and Newegg.com. And for a limited time, you can get a free $300 gift card with purchase. Visit a Microsoft store near you today to learn more.
Moment of science. Guys, we might be sick.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know about this, but the WHO came out with a new designation in its International Statistical Classification of Diseases, and we might be suffering from gaming disorder.
Who's we here?
If the disorder persists for more than 4 hours, please stop gaming. No. There was a new classification that came out, and in a section that defined future research to be conducted, one of the disorders they classified was something called gaming disorder. The rationale behind this is they're seeing a rise in specific cases related to addiction to gaming. And so there was encouragement to do more research in this area. There's been a lot of pushback from scientists even considering that, because by putting it in this classification, you're incentivizing work that's going to be biased towards finding a pro finding around this, and you create kind of like this weird kind of panic that video games harm people when there's basically just no evidence to it.
Well, the classification says that there are three criteria, right? They all have to do with basically the same thing, which is you're playing games so much that the rest of your life is going to shit.
Yeah, and which is classic addiction behavior, right? And you could say the same thing for other addiction based behavior, whether it's like drinking too much alcohol, like being addicted to drugs. But the thing is, there's actual quantitative effects to those beyond it having impacts throughout the rest of your life. This is sort of like a few headlines garnering a lot of story. There is a lot of scientists who have come out and said there's not evidence showing games have any particular destructive behavior outside of people just playing too much, which is not a disorder unto itself.
Well, there's a similar disorder called gambling disorder that some of these articles referenced. Can you not make the same argument about that?
I think what's slightly different about gambling, and this is, I'm not a professional psychiatrist here, but what I think is different about gambling is the environment and the huge ramifications to financial status that comes from that we've only seen in limited ways within gaming. Like, you could lose $10,000 gambling like that. That's much harder to do in gaming. That'll have ramifications for your life for an extended period of time. Also, the constructions of places that where gambling occurs are tend to foster certain behaviors. It's harder. You can make that case with gaming, but it's less so because most gamers just game at home in their own environment.
I think a lot of people are going to latch onto this and think if they play a lot of games and that's all they do, they have gaming disorder. From what I understand, what they're proposing is it's more like that episode of South Park where dude gets completely lost in World of Warcraft and becomes, he doesn't leave the desk and he gets you know, Hot Pockets from his mom delivered. Mm-hmm. And that's all he does.
Yeah, but that's not about the game necessarily.
No.
There might be aspects of the game that encourage that behavior because of just how the game mechanics are structured.
Gaming's so broad.
But yeah, I think this is one where I would push it to the side. There's a lot of pushback from the scientific community.
They also say 12 months. It has to, you'd have these symptoms for 12 months before you would have any kind of affliction.
I guess so. I mean, I guess I'm of that Cialis mindset. If it persists for that long, you should seek medical attention. All right. The next story comes about prosthetics. And we've talked about, you know, robots having force feedback mechanisms so they can better sense the environment, especially when gripping, which is this incredibly complicated set of practices to latch onto, you know, various objects that we sort of take for granted. And so some of the limitations of force feedback when it comes to just robotic arms is that it just generally gives you a sensation, but it's not indicative of the full sensation that we feel. So when it comes to prosthetic limbs and people trying to recreate sensations that are much more human-like, they want to be able to, when they pick up something like I'm picking up this Diet Coke can, feel that it's slightly cold or at this edge it's a little bit sharp.
Well, and if you can't feel the resistance, might as well feel pain.
Yeah, and so, but that's what they're getting at, is that a little bit of pain actually creates a sense of realism and a sense of space that's actually very useful. And so a group actually structured a new type of prosthetic that tries to mimic the pathways of pain. And so in a human, like in the fingertips, I have nociceptors that are essentially transmitting electrical signals up to my brain, and I have mechanoreceptors up there that are translating that signal into a sensation of pain. All of that happens really quickly, and there's chemical processes associated with that too for different types of pain. What they tried to do is mimic that through electrical circuits so that they would have an end of this prosthetic limb be able to translate some basic information about an object as it's grabbing onto and create very mild sensations of pain. Like on the 1 to 10 scale, we're talking like in that 1 to 3 region. So mm-hmm. Nothing like uncomfortable by any stretch of the imagination. But what they found is with those sensations, the users reported a greater deal of like a return to normalcy, if you will. Like it felt just more real. There was more presence, and they were able to better grip and hang on to objects because they had more robust information about it. What I think is going to be interesting is if their plasticity of their brain can then actually adjust to these signals in a way and map it and create a sensation of pain where, you know, on just these underlying electrical signals.
I think there's a parallel with haptic feedback for game controllers, where we found decades ago that just a little bit of rumble can be anything, and it's so much more immersing.
Didn't you guys try that haptic? It was a VR haptic that created the sensation of, like, hot and cold and translated that into pain?
Yes, that was freaky.
And it was really freaky, right?
Yeah.
But I think like the question then becomes like, if you use that over and over again, would that create a better sense of presence as your brain adjusts to that sensation? I don't know. It's
I don't either. I want to tone down the intensity of that thing, though.
Well, that I think that was your complaint about that. Yeah. About that. That was probably like 6-7 on this scale, as opposed to what they're trying to do here, which is much toned down, because I don't think they want to ever recreate the, you know, be able to recreate a prosthetic that actually mimics real pain. Last story this week is about a project that will be displayed at an upcoming conference in Pittsburgh on robots. Jeremy, you just released a video untested last week about The Sims that used an EEG headset. The NeuroSky, it was called.
Yep.
Right. And what did you do with that EEG headset?
We talked a little bit about that a few weeks ago on the podcast. It's a headset that costs $100 about, and it gets very basic EEG readings from your head by touching your forehead and your earlobe, and it can give you. It's supposed to be able to give you a reading of how strong your attention is, and how good your meditation level is, whatever that means. But it will also give you all these alpha, beta, gamma, theta waves and allow you to interpret them if you're capable of doing that.
So, I mean, with two inputs, essentially, like two areas it was taking readings, might take like three. It was able to interpret these electrical signals from your brain and execute actions based on them. We were playing around with this in the office when you were building this a few weeks ago. While we could get it to train and definitely work, it was fidgety. And so even if you scale that up to scientific EEG, which has many more inputs across your entire brain, it's still a very fidgety enterprise. And so when people have used EEG to execute actions on like a robot across the room to like, you know, make a maneuver, like those KUKA robots, like those hand robots, like go pick up this thing or go point at this, they've always had a degree of failure like of around 30%. Just because of the inaccuracy of the technology to accurately read those electrical signals. For something like NeuroSky, where you even have less degrees of freedom, it's even higher than that. What this new group did was essentially pair that with a new sort of predictive technology that is essentially learning what waves are happening in your brain and essentially let you to train up on them.
So you don't directly command, you're just error correction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it has like a feedback loop, essentially. Mm-hmm. So, and they're reporting, and we need a lot more information about this, there isn't a paper out about this, is that when they had a robot arm controlling a drill, that with this setup, they're able to get it to its location with 97% accuracy with limited training.
And what does the user do in order to make the drill move?
As you just think about it moving to that location. It's no different than the EEG.
Well, but that's very different because, I mean, I couldn't have a distinct thought and have that reflected in my readings at all.
See, well, the difference here is there's some, you know, processing that's happening that's recognizing that you want to do this task and move it here and trains the system to recognize that signal as that thought. And then as you go through, it's catching those errors and like, moving it forward. It's learning.
I want to know more about that because you can't just think about a location. Like, it can't translate that. You would have to train it to move in a specific direction with a specific thought.
And there's probably some gestures related to this as well.
That's
in the training process, but this will be something to track going forward. All robots all the time this week. That's it.
The VR Minute. Virtual reality. This week.
Whew. We're going to pick up on some E3 news we didn't talk about last week. One of the big games announced for VR but not shown in public demos in at E3 was Insomniac Games' new game, Stormland.
Mm-hmm. Their fourth VR title. That's pretty good.
That right?
Yeah.
Wow, Edge of Nowhere. We talked about the announcement, but there was a big sit-down at the E3 Coliseum between Insomniac, the director there, and Jason Rubin of Oculus about the making of this game and gave a little more details and showed a little more gameplay about exactly how it would play out. So it's like we said, you know, one of the very popular fads in game right now is both single and multiplayer experiences being combined, a single-player game that you can also play with some of your friends, and this is no different. It's an open world, and you fly through that world and climb. You're a robot climbing through that world, flying with your hands forward, gliding through, riding winds.
That's the big thing to me is that locomotion that they're showing off in these videos. It looks way more intense than any of their other games.
And it has stick movement. You can be able to, you know, walk around. I don't think it has teleport, but it's mostly like you're climbing rocks and then jumping off, turning around, and flying, gliding, riding waves of air. To travel long distances.
It looks to me like you can't fly and change direction a whole lot. Like they seem to be doing some smart things about constant speed and direction.
Right. No rolling, of course, when you're flying.
Which is exactly what happens in Echo Arena.
Mm-hmm.
Constant speed. You have thrusters, so you can influence it.
Right.
But it's subtle.
Right. Right. And they'll probably vignette it. You know, and this is one of the reasons that you're a robot. Because then they can do all these kind of tricks to make the movement seem natural.
Looks way cool. You can climb any surface, kind of like Zelda. And I'm excited to try that. But I'm most excited just about this locomotion, just moving around like they showed in this video.
And tied to that is how big the world potentially is. And hopefully the world is big and it'll be lots of different types of environments that you can travel. It won't all look just the same. Like the thing I'm afraid of is it's going to fall into maybe the Borderlands trap of it all having the same kind of palette and being a little repetitive. Like give us a lot of different types of environments.
I don't know.
In
we're
this open world.
Still early days. I know that we're in this new era of the bigger budget, longer development cycle VR titles. But, you know, baby steps, baby steps.
Yep,
you know,
yep.
If it's a cool idea, it doesn't necessarily need to have 40 hours of gameplay for me.
Right. What's also going on right now when we're recording this, and by the time you listen to this, maybe it'll still be going on, is the Echo Combat open beta.
Started 2 hours ago.
Oh, my goodness. We played this at E3. We're so jazzed to get into the open beta. Developers are going to be there. And they've launched, I think it's a new app called Echo VR, which is basically their hub. Because previously you launch Echo Arena. And then you're in the lobby, and then you jump into a game. Now they have Echo Arena and Echo Combat, so they have a new lobby environment where this is, I think this is them dipping their toes in the metaverse.
Mm-hmm.
This is the space station we're hoping for, getting bigger and bigger.
I don't know. Rec Room's kind of got them beat.
Yeah. Well, this is the equivalent of that Rec Room style, the Rec Room.
It is. It is very much that.
And I encourage them to have more activities in that VR space. If it's going to be a social environment for lobbies, for people to jump in the Echo Combat and Echo Arena, I can't wait to jump in. Developers are going to be playing the whole weekend. They'll have special badges so you can see which player is the developer.
I'm sure all three of us will be playing.
Mm-hmm.
They've admitted it's not perfect. There's no team private matches or team-based matchmaking. It's just jump into a random game with five other people. And not all the weapons are there, and they have there's a bug list, so don't expect it to be a perfect experience. And it's also only right-handers right now, no left-handed gun control.
It's not the same build we played at E3. They got rid of one of the tech mods, so it's reverted back to the original closed beta. But the guns all have new models. They have unique models.
I love
now.
The animation.
Yeah, it's all good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what makes it hard for these guys to iterate quite as fast as the Rec Room guys, because they have a lot of small details.
Art they need in animations they need to build in. And IK. Actually, you have feet. Like, you don't have feet in Rec Room.
Did you watch the whole Jason Rubin interview, by the way?
A lot of it, yeah.
He referred to Santa Cruz at one point, he talked about that having stadium scale.
Yeah, you can just keep on going and going and going.
Yeah.
What does that mean for boundaries and chaperones and...
Yeah, it made me think about the choices you have to make as a developer, because you have already a niche audience. And if you talk about playing with boundaries and going outside anything that's simple standing scale, you're talking about narrowing that niche even further.
And, you know, stadiums are flat. So what is that? I want elevation.
Yeah. You want to use your stairs?
I want stairs to be possible.
I do think that there's definitely potential for a Santa Cruz-like product, or even Windows Mixed Reality if you strapped it to a backpack or something, to world map your house and then turn it into something.
Right.
And then let people explore it.
Well, at that point, it's just AR.
I want it to be virtual, you know, in a Void-style way. You know, but I incorporate the real world.
Yeah. No, mop your floors, get rid of all the toys, pick up all the toys before you start
That's
this.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, just walls. There's walls. I mean, an open platform for location-based level design.
Exactly.
Is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Where you can rent out space, put up some cardboard walls or whatever walls, and have something there. Back to the living room. Microsoft has said for the longest time that when they announced the Xbox One X Scorpio, that it would have support for VR. They're walking back on that. Xbox One X will have no... They said it's VR for them, their Windows Mixed Reality initiative, will be PC only for the foreseeable future.
Disappointing, but also not surprising, given their announcement last week of a new console in 2020. Why would they make investments in VR for the next 2 years? Now, I'd be super disappointed if that system in 2020 doesn't have support for VR.
My feeling is that it won't.
Really? I mean, it is still... I don't think the market has proven to be a system seller yet. I don't know.
I think they're afraid it'll be Kinect. They're afraid it'll be like Kinect for the Xbox One.
I guess it comes down to PlayStation and how jealous Microsoft is of them.
Well, they're only jealous if PlayStation's making money.
But there's a difference in building support for it in the system versus actually marketing and going to market with a product.
Well, the Xbox One X has the support. It has all the hardware necessary.
Yes.
And it's such a powerful console. Like, that was one of the most exciting things about
Yeah.
Is that support?
It's a little disappointing, especially for VR enthusiasts. Last week, we mentioned that Oculus and John Carmack were working on a video pre-rendered version of the Henry.
Oh my God! Did you see this?
I did, and I think I made a mistake. It's not 180; it's 360.
It's totally 360.
It's totally 360. It's interesting because the video fidelity is great, but if you move your head quickly enough, you can see.
Yeah.
The image gets sharper and load in.
Totally acceptable trade-off. I was shocked. I was shocked when I saw this video.
Yeah, 360.
So it's a 360 video, which is, as you said before I interrupted you, it was a rendering of the real-time Henry experience that they released for the Oculus Rift maybe 2 years ago.
Yeah, the Story Studio.
And I expected it to be the best video I've seen. I didn't expect it to look real-time, and it looks real-time.
You can't see the compression, really, unless you're moving your head extremely quickly.
Yeah.
To new parts of the scene.
Now, of course, this is for the Oculus Go and some phones on Gear VR.
Yep.
So you don't get 6 degrees of freedom, so it lends itself to a rendered video. If you were able to move your head around, then that would be something we haven't seen before.
Right, right. And I think a lot of the benefit is the visual style of this being cartoony, and also a lot of the motion and action being focused in one place. So you're not seeing a lot of things happen behind you. They don't have to compensate for that in the data stream. It's 360, 60 FPS, and it maximizes those 5,000 pixels across.
Yeah, so as you were saying, when you turn your head, you can see the higher resolution video resolve, and that's because of Carmack's new magic way of rendering this video, which is in strips. There's a complete 2K video that wraps around you at all times, but then whichever direction you look at, it pulls in from three or four other videos the high-res data for that area.
That's why it's a pretty big file. It's like 5 gigabytes.
Is it that big?
Yeah.
I thought it was a little over one.
But it's big for this film.
Yeah, it's probably bigger than the real-time executable was.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The assets. But, you know, this is it. I think he's taking his lessons learned from like rendering on GPUs, like, you know, Rage. Right, like his mega textures.
Just render what you can see, too, which was exactly the way that they did Quake.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, it's super cool.
On the Vive side, a couple actually big announcements. Vive, a while ago, opened up for SteamVR controller mapping. So taking your whatever existing VR controllers you have, whether it's the Vive Ones or the Oculus Rift controllers, and then letting developers and users map the actions and buttons on those to keyboard, mouse, or gamepad, so you could basically port games to VR easily. Now they have something called SteamVR Skeletal Input, and this is basically helping developers and users map their gestures or hand poses in their existing controllers to hand presence, to skeletal models.
What?
So you got to open the link. So basically, you can on like the Vive Wand. Right now, you have on the Vive Wand, you have the big touchpad.
Yeah.
Right. And what you do on the touchpad, where your finger is placed on the touchpad, is mapped essentially to where your thumb would be in hand presence.
Weird.
In VR.
Okay.
You can now make those gestures tied to other types of hand poses.
Like macros?
Exactly. Like macros.
Okay.
This is
because you don't have perfect one to one.
Right.
Mapping on the controllers. And we know that you don't need perfect one to one to make to have believable hand presence.
No, but you're never gonna get people aren't gonna buy into this unless it's natural.
I think it's gonna feel more natural than you think.
The nice thing about touch is that when you point, it points. Like where your fingers
right.
fall.
It still cheats. It still cheats a bit.
Yeah.
Because you don't have like pinky tracking.
Right.
Right? So right. This allows you to kind of customize
yeah.
for your game. Like your Spider-Man game, where how the pinky would stick out when you press a button when you're doing web slinging.
I'm curious what the process to learn and program that it like looks like and how long that takes, because that'll speak to what Jeremy says. It has to be natural for it to.
Really, this is bearing the lead for their support for their new thing, because none of those controllers, the Vive Wand or the Oculus Touch controller, are potentially as good as what they have in development, which is their Knuckles controller.
I'm glad to hear it's still in development, frankly.
And not only is it still in development, there's a second version that they're shipping to developers.
What?
Yeah. A redesign. that's where we bared the lead. The Knuckles 2, and there's a landing page on the Steam community site that shows that it goes through the details. First big thing, on the top of it, they have a thumbstick now.
Ooh.
A thumbstick, which a lot of people really want.
That's a big concession.
Big concession. Thumbstick on Knuckles controller. The second thing is that touchpad is no longer, it's not a circle, it's a strip now. It's like a oval.
Okay.
A vertical oval.
You mean next to the
analog stick? Next to the thumbstick. Exactly. Between the buttons.
Okay.
They've also improved the cap sense for your fingers. Now force sensitivity.
Whoa.
Gripping strength for your thumb and for your fingers. That, I think, is going to be hugely powerful for some games. Imagine playing a climbing game where it's not just about having your fingers on the controller, but you have to actually grip.
Oh, God. More physical exertion.
People are using Beat Saber for exercise every day, Jeremy.
I know. Dan Emmerich straps 1 pound weights to his wrist.
It's a workout.
I can imagine.
Through the fire and flames.
That's cool. Let's get one in, Norm.
I would love to. Hey, no NDAs for developers. If you're a developer in the Bay Area and you have Knuckles version 2, let's chat. Reach out to us on Twitter or send us an email, norman@tesla.com.
USB-C charging port.
Yeah. Very cool. And that does it for the VR Minute this week. We gotta get to what we've been watching. We're running real long. Let's get to our final segment.
All right, and now the reel.
Top story this week.
Oh,
my you just
goodness.
Managed to shut off the lights. See?
That won't do.
That's much harder than you think it is.
What, changing the lights?
Changing the lights.
I think we got the remotes all reversed or something.
Here, let me have it.
All right.
I've mucked this up. While Jeremy tries to
fix the
lights.
We've all seen The Incredibles too.
Yes. Yeah, we have. All right. Let's start with Bao.
I think we should save that to the end.
No, let's just not get it, because it's not going to take long.
All right.
It's not going to take long.
Mm-hmm.
Bao, right, new short, very different than their other shorts.
Aesthetically, story-wise, no dialogue.
That's consistent.
And it's a surrealist story.
Just the moment she eats.
Are we going to spoil this directly?
Yeah, no, you guys, we're going to, it's just, it's all right, spoilers.
The light is green. We've got spoilers right now. If you're listening to audio, we're going to do nothing else but spoilers for the rest of the cast.
Everyone's totally on board with this being she, and it is a she. It's the mother, right?
It's a mother.
But that was not clear to me at first.
Wait,
I don't
what?
Know. Why is everyone so clear about this? She looks so much younger than the dad and is not clearly feminine. I thought maybe it was a brother for the longest time.
Thought it was just totally motherly behavior.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's very gender specific of you. And just the fact that she was making dinner should not necessarily mean it was a she.
No, no, just the
earring,
loving.
Yeah.
Like
it was
major.
100%
nurturing.
Mother.
Okay.
You need to watch it again.
I did.
That's going to change.
I saw it twice. I'm on board with that.
Yeah.
I was just surprised that everybody had just totally got that because I didn't.
Oh,
that was not clear to me the first time.
All right. Well, super funny. And then it got to a moment. I think is it the first Pixar short that has a turn like this?
What do you mean?
There's a turn in the short when she eats the dumpling.
I mean, you know, that was an important dramatic moment.
People gasped.
I
the reactions were all over the place.
I didn't see that coming. And then when, you know, the sun comes in.
That was a nice reveal.
It was such a great reveal. And like as a parent, I was like, oh, I get that. Also, like as a immigrant child, I also sort of get that feeling. I've had conversations with my mom that are not so dissimilar to the feeling
she'd want to consume you. She'd want to put you back in the womb.
No, that idea of protection, yeah.
That's what it
that
was.
Got
That's
personal.
Not where he went.
That got personal real quick.
I didn't like what a dick he was. Like he was the whole time he was growing
That's
up.
It's adolescence.
It's more than that, dude. That was a bad child. Like he was not kind to his mother.
You say that as a father.
He was not kind. Like he was a real bastard.
Yeah.
And she should be angry at him.
And that's her perception too. That's what she remembers.
That's all we have to base our judgment on. We didn't see his
perspective. But I think that the point of that short film is that's how parents feel when their children leave them. They remember
they're so hurt that they remember these the good parts, and they remember it suddenly turning.
Bow's gonna bow, man. I will say, like, you know, it's not as crowd pleasing as like the Puffin one and like some of the other ones they had.
Day and night.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And like, like that is the short is the exact place they should be taking risks like this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed the spit out of it.
Spit. Okay. Yeah. All right. I like the dad watching TV at dinner. Like that just seemed very real.
The whole thing.
It wasn't saccharine.
You know, it was directed by someone from who related her personal experience to this, right? And they modeled the home after her childhood home. And
what role would she have played in her personal experience?
She was a child who, in her conversations with her mother, like her mother at times would say, and these are from interviews, I wish I could keep you forever.
Yeah.
And every child has to leave their parents at some point, and every parent feels, you know, feels traumatic about it.
And this isn't the first time they've
When your children leave you, maybe you'll feel the same way.
This isn't the first time they've done that with the, you know, the director of the short, like Sanjay Super Team, very similar, modeled after his childhood, like very drawing from a lot of personal stories of the creator. So
I just felt like that was a little more relatable. This one was,
well, for me it was, yeah.
I mean, as an Indian man myself, I found that very relatable. But I just felt like the interest in things that your parents don't understand, that's a little more down to earth than just this dick child who just like puts on glasses and slams the door in his mom's face left and right.
I felt extremely relatable.
Really?
Extremely relatable. This one struck a chord.
I almost texted Norm. I was like, like I was looking for an emoji of a bow.
Yeah. Are you
not exist.
Yeah. You're not okay. You're not necessarily from the first person perspective, or
what do you mean from the first?
I don't know, because you have a bigger family than just you and your parents.
Yeah, no, it's relatable.
Okay, all right.
You know, and the food looked good. They said the hardest thing to render and design was the food. You know, the soft shapes.
That's interesting. Forms. I'm always curious what's hard to render.
Yeah, because you know CG is really good for hard bodies and. And that kind of like the mix,
mm-hmm.
And that food looked really good when she made the banquet.
She made the whole table and it was all steaming hot. How do you do that? That's hard.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
And he slammed that door right in her face.
Ugh. Stop making me hungry. On to the main event. I was surprised by one thing. I didn't expect it to pick up
right after.
Oh, I'd read that. Yeah, I knew.
Oh,
that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Underminer.
Underminer.
Cliff.
Nothing's beneath me.
Better villain than I thought he would be. I thought he was good. They're going to clean him up.
All right. I don't know how to talk about this because while we have not, the three of us have not gone into the specifics of this movie, I think there's I can feel where this is going. So, Jeremy, the resident Pixar,
All right. Well, look, you talk about The Incredibles. You're talking about one of the best movies ever made, right? Can we all agree on that?
Yes.
Arguably, it's my favorite Pixar movie. Pixar has made 20 movies to date. And I think The Incredibles was the sixth movie that they made. I think you could argue that it is still the best of their entire catalog. It might not be, and you might not agree with that, but you could make that argument. It is definitely in the top five. So when you're talking about a sequel, it's hard. You're living up to true greatness. So what I went into was hoping that it would be just as good as The Incredibles. I'm not sure that it is, but it is a great movie. They did a great job. It has all the things you want to see. It has the family using their powers together, which we got at the end of The Incredibles. So you get more of that. You get the like probably the best action scenes in Pixar's catalog. They're amazing action scenes with choreography that just knocks you out left and right. I mean, great, great camera work. You get to see Jack-Jack using Jack-Jack's powers, which was an interesting twist. Like, you knew that he had powers, but the family didn't at the end of the first movie.
Right.
So you get to see them discover that. That's terrific.
I don't think you even knew until they realize.
No, you
saw it.
You knew because when he got stolen by Syndrome at the end.
Phone calls. Right.
No. That scene with the raccoon is fantastic. It's great, great fun.
Yep.
You know, so it's all there. But even Brad Bird describes it as a popcorn movie. Like it is a action movie that's there to have, you know, provide a good time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it does that. And it's great. Look, it's blockbuster success.
It's not groundbreaking.
It's great. It's just, I don't know. It's not what I thought I was going to get.
What did you think I was going to get? I mean, no movie can live up to the novelty of the original,
mm-hmm.
the discovery of that world and those characters.
No, you're right. The first thing you see in The Incredibles is three people you've never seen in your entire life being interviewed for TV.
Right. It was super, and it was also like a superhero film before superhero films.
Yeah,
14 years ago.
But you know, I just feel like, I mean, if I'm allowed to nitpick, which I see it's successful, I'm not complaining.
Let's get the allowance on the table.
But look at the stakes. I think what it comes down to is the stakes are different in the movies. In the first movie, let's start with the villain. The villain.
I love Syndrome.
In the first movie,
not his role, but I love the take they had on his origins and his motivation.
You know the villain. You meet the villain long before he is the villain.
Yeah.
And you think he's funny. You think he's dismissible.
Yeah.
He's a fanboy.
Right.
And he becomes a villain because he was dismissed. You dismissed him.
Yeah.
You are complicit in making him the bad guy.
Which is a superhero trope that you created the villain.
The dichotomies are there. You know, taking seriously technology versus natural gifts, all of that.
And then he becomes such a bad guy that he kills superheroes. He kills them. Mm-hmm. There's a record of like all these superheroes that he has destroyed using his technology.
The corpse of Gazerbeam.
Before they get to Mr. Incredible and his encounter
with
him.
It's dark. It's dark.
It is dark.
People die. Henchmen die. We watch that, the first Incredibles, and like we make a little drinking game out of like, that person's dead. That person's dead. Henchmen fly into a wall, exploding vehicle, dead.
And the stakes are the death of all superheroes and robots, you know, destroying
cities.
But
that's not the real stake.
And Syndrome wanting to sell his technology and make everybody super.
That's inconsequential. That's generic. The real stakes of Incredibles 1 is the relationship between Mr. Incredible, Mrs. Incredible, the family, and his insecurity. That is the reason, for me, why that movie is so powerful.
Yeah, well, then you probably love the second one.
No, but I agree. Where the second one, those same stakes were rehashed.
Yes, I'll push back slightly on this in the sense that, what is her name? Evelyn? Is that her name?
Yeah, so the villains in the new film are, again, they're not even that memorable. The brother and sister.
He's not a villain, though.
He's not. And I think they played so much on the misdirection, and they tried to make a villain a reveal, and that hurt their characterizations.
Totally agree, but what I like about the symmetry of it is how being a superhero brought this family together, them embracing the superhero dynamic, and the reverse is true for Evelyn, is that superheroes destroyed her family, and that was her motivation.
The over-reliance on superheroes.
Yeah, and that didn't come through as much as you wanted, but I saw where they were going with that.
No, totally, and that's also another trope that's been in comics, the over-reliance on superheroes to save you, and I agree. I wish they had dove deeper into that. Not necessarily with monologuing, which Syndrome did a lot of, but in subtle ways. I am fine with it being a popcorn movie.
It was really great.
It was freaking incredible.
I'm with you, man. I'm fine with that, too. I'm fine with that, too.
I would watch it over and over and over again for those action scenes. Yeah. Oh, my. The wrist. Mm-hmm. They did, and to some extent they did with Fine and Jordan as well, but I think they did better here, where the film not only holds up and the characters look like how they look in your head, but orders of magnitude actually better than what they look like in the first film, retain that style.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then creatively did so much with the action scenes. When Elastigirl is flying through the city, when she's on her bike, and that chase scene
with the train,
incredible with this train, and also the fight scene with the screen slaver, with the hypnotic fight scene.
The pizza guy.
I want to frame by frame that because there's some crazy stuff going on.
Like, when you look at the credits and they have, you know, they have supervisors for CG, they have supervisors for camera and for lighting, those people should win some Academy Awards. Because it's like it's some cinematography that surpasses what you'd see in live action.
What I was expecting that they didn't do was the classic superhero mistake, and they like only semi did this. Elastigirl was mega competent. I thought they were setting her up for like some sort of failure or something else where everyone has to come in and kind of save her. And while that still kind of happened, it didn't happen because of like she was always on top of stuff, figuring it out. She was like, she was the one pushing the story forward. I thought that was phenomenal. The one nitpick I have is we got the Dilbertism of Mr. Incredible in the first movie, which was incredible, just seeing him beaten down by corporate America.
Driving home in his small car.
And they just played that same note with him as single dad.
You know what I felt like, and this might be totally off base, but what's the name of the actor that plays Mr. Incredible?
Craig T. Nelson.
Craig T. Nelson.
Coach.
So they've all grown 15 years, but or is it more than that?
14 years.
But his voice probably sounds the most different, although except for Dash. I don't know how they remade Dash's voice.
They found a new kid.
Did they?
Yeah.
It's not the same actor?
It's a different actor.
He did a great job. Like, he sounded just like him. But Craig T. Nelson's voice sounds a little bit like an older gentleman now. And I felt like they gave him a role where that would work, where he's exhausted.
Yeah.
Like, he's gotten no sleep. He's doing all these things that he has no idea how to do. They changed math on him.
Yeah. That was pretty funny. Jack-Jack was a little overpowered for me.
Oh, I love that. It was baby. It was what a baby is.
It's but like, he didn't... It wasn't overpowered where he saved the day.
No,
it was overpowered.
I guess that's
in that,
true.
Like, it was just... You had the raccoon fight scene, which is like, its own short
That was amazing.
Film.
Yeah. It was like a short film.
Of,
yeah.
Of just British-style, like, physical comedy. Mm-hmm. Right? And they had the payoff with the laser beams and everything. Everything paid off. And yeah, they hit this lot of the same notes with Edna Mode but like it was hilarious.
Yeah.
It was so well written and directed.
It was totally enjoyable. Last week I said there was a review that said a sequel worthy of the original, and I think it lived up to that line.
Okay, now hold on. That's my whole point, is it didn't. It didn't.
No. Worthy of the original? For sure. As a sequel. It's not as good as.
Okay.
Worthy is different than as good as.
There's a lot of nuance there. Like, in the first movie, you remember when when Mrs. Incredible is going to save Mr. Incredible, and the kids stow away, and she's angry at them.
Yeah.
And
Elastigirl. What's called Elastigirl?
What did I say?
Mrs. Incredible.
Oh, God. That's horrible. Yeah. No, sorry. Elastigirl. Yeah. And then the missiles get shot at the plane, and then she tells Violet to... You know, do a force field around the plane. You have to do this.
Yeah. There's moments of vulnerability.
And she tries and she tries and she doesn't do it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was an incredible moment.
Yeah.
And it's because, like, they never let her use her powers, right? Like, while she was growing up. And then there's this whole subtext to it. You don't have that in this movie. There's no moment like that of unexpected failure. And that's like, those are the scenes I wanted, because that's the real family stuff.
Yeah. I agree. It was a lot of more of the same in really done really, really well.
I got to say, I love Underminer at the last film. I like him more now.
You loved Underminer. Right on, man.
Come on. Yeah. He was one of the best characters from the first film.
He's funny. It's
I like him even more.
Score was consistent.
What?
The score.
Oh, the score was great. The score was great. I love the music in those movies.
It looked at I keep on going to that one shot where she's going through the city, and it's very like sepia toned.
You mean where she's on the hunt?
Yeah, on the hunt. Yeah.
That's very cool.
I loved how everything looked.
Sarah Vowell, I thought, did an even better job this time around.
Being
as
Violet.
The voice of Violet. She's really good.
Yeah.
I loved the new superheroes, you know, for the most part. I think Void has the most interesting powers of any superhero.
When Void activates the portal and they're like, she, when they're trying to get on the plane, and she can't get Elastigirl on the plane, and then has one, the portal flip upside down.
Yeah, she flies.
And she has the momentum. Yeah. I love that moment.
Yeah, yeah. You want to use that. You want to fly through those.
Oh, yeah.
You want her as a friend.
Oh, yeah. And it's a fun thing when they were fighting each other too.
Yeah. Although, the character felt oddly DreamWorksy to me. Like, if there was a superhero in How to Train Your Dragon, I think it would be Void. She seemed very, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if they were made to be super memorable, but they needed villains to fight.
I'll ask one provocative question. You think it's good enough to get a Best Picture nomination?
No.
Like, we're waiting for that animated movie to finally break through and get a Best Picture nomination.
I don't think this is it.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. But I don't think it's because it may not be one of the five best films of the year. I think it's just because of the bias that exists. It may end up being one of the five best films of the year, mm-hmm. or 10 best. Mm. Now, whatever.
I'm glad we have it. However, for me, this is an example of demanding something from a director, the director giving you what they've got, and you saying, okay, well, maybe that's why you hadn't made it yet. You know, because it's not,
yeah.
It's hard to live up to the first one.
I don't, do you need another one?
Definitely not need, but I would love another one of these.
I mean, this is a TV series. Every movie ends with a cliffhanger. This is supposed to be a TV show.
Yeah.
I could see this being a...
Would you rather Brad Bird make Incredibles 3 or do something new and have someone else be okay writing and directing Incredibles 3?
You know, those are the only two movies in Pixar's pantheon that have been written and directed by one person. So I don't know if he would let go.
That's a tough thing. See,
I mean, given what he did with something like Iron Giant, which is, I think a classic that will live generations, I want to see him do something new.
Yeah, but he's done a few films since Incredibles,
sure.
mm-hmm. all live action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ooh. All right. We got through our spoilers. We got through everything. It's an especially long podcast this week. Thank you all out there for listening. I may not be here next week, depending on when we record, because I'm going to go to New York. I would love some food recommendations for New York. I don't want to go to a lot of the same places again, because sure, you and I should talk definitely after the podcast about that. And if you know of cool things to do in New York, feel free to send them my way. We're definitely going to do Intrepid Museum, Museum Moving Image, all that jazz. Thanks for listening. And do we have an outro?
I don't know.
Let me see.
Let me check it out.
Maybe. Yeah.
Maybe.
You want the earliest one I've got from 6 years ago?
Let's do it.
All right, here we go. Oh, this is, that's Will's actual template.
Yeah, not the template.
Not the template.
Not the template.
The template would just be
the next
empty
one after
sound.
The template.
That's funny. Oh gosh.
Wow. I don't know if any of them exist.
Oh wow. All right, sorry. I'm going to go to newest then. I'll do an old one from the new team. Here's one from 9 months ago.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
That's it.
Wait, weird. Is that Justin, a.k.a. Speed?
No. That would have been funny. No, I believe his name is Michael.
That's it.
That was by Justin, a.k.a. Speed, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Awesome. All right. See you.